Morning sessions are always interesting. Interesting because I'm not sure if anyone's going to be awake to hear me. I'm reminded of the fellow that woke up one Sunday morning and didn't want to go to church. And his mother shouted up to him to his bedroom, says, "Son, get up. You have to go to church." "I don't want to go to church." She said, "You have to go to church." "I don't want to go to church." And it went back and forth. And finally she said, "Give me three good reasons why you shouldn't go to church." He said, "That's easy. One, I'm just too tired. Two, the people at that church aren't friendly. Number three, I don't think they want me to come." He said, "Now you give me three reasons why I should go to church." And she said, "Well, that's easy. Number one, you just ought to go to church. You know that. It's just right. You ought to go to church. And number two, you're a big boy now and you ought to be able to deal with your problems. Number three, you're the pastor." We've been there, haven't we, Bill? A couple of things were mentioned in the question time afterwards yesterday. I didn't really anticipate the interest in the subject of self-esteem. I mentioned it sort of by the way, and that was all it was intended to be, but there are many questions on it. Let me just say this in case there are more questions. Don wants me to move this. Is that better, Don? And that is, the self-esteem movement as such is just so full of unbiblical notions that you need to be aware of it. Now, what becomes confusing about it with many is that we have all known children, or known of children at least, who lacked confidence, who lacked assurance, or whatever, and they needed help in that particular area. And I don't know of anyone who's willing to deny that. But all of the baggage that comes with the self-esteem terminology is really what I'm after when I made the remark that I did. And if you are interested in that issue, or if you even have questions about that issue, again, I want to recommend Jay Adams' book, A Biblical View of Self-Esteem and Self-Love, I think it's called. Just a very, very good treatment of the subject. I mentioned yesterday that I've never been asked to speak on this subject at a conference. I've only spoken on this subject at my own church. There are some advantages to being at a conference like this and speaking on it. And one of them is that I really don't know you folks, and I don't have to worry about your getting mad at me thinking that I was gunning for you if I say anything that really is barking up your tree, so to speak. And that makes it a little bit more comfortable for me. The other problem, though, that comes with that is that being that I don't know you, I may not be as careful as maybe I should be in being sensitive in some issues. And I want you to understand that I certainly don't mean to be that way. And if when we talk about parents who fail or make mistakes in different ways, I certainly don't want you to be hurt by it, but understand that it's warning to all of the rest of us who still have younger children, and we're working toward a happy conclusion with that. Yesterday, there are no more outlines left, I guess. If you don't have an outline, try to find someone who does. You can follow along. Yesterday, the main thing I think that we need to reemphasize is this matter of parenting and stewardship. Keep it in the forefront of your mind as a parent that your home is to be a training ground for that child, for those children. Those children have been entrusted to us, and it is our responsibility before God to train them to live for Christ. That is the reason that we have them and nothing else. A lot of other things come in, a lot of other interests, and that's fine. And we may mention some of that tomorrow probably. But remember, first and foremost, our responsibility is to train them for God. And that has to guide everything else that we do and really every decision that we make. Now for today, let's begin with Proverbs again. Proverbs chapter 1. And really, this is just to reemphasize something that was mentioned yesterday. Proverbs chapter 1. You're probably aware that these first seven verses are sort of an introduction to the book as a whole, where the title is stated first off, and the author, or the main contributing author. The purpose of the book is stated in the verses 2 through 7. And what Proverbs does, unlike any other book in the Bible, except perhaps the book of Revelation, which promises a blessing to those who read it, the book of Proverbs promises great blessings, and it's very specific and it's very comprehensive at the same time about the blessings that it offers to those who read and learn the wisdom in the book of Proverbs. But then we get to verse 7, and we have the motto, or the theme of the book. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Now, I won't take the time to explain what fear is. I think you're all at least somewhat familiar with that. It has the idea of respect and reverence. It also, I am convinced, has the idea of fear retained in it that we have very often forgot. But when it says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, that is, it is the principal part, it is fundamental to knowledge. This is the beginning point. This is the basic ingredient to knowledge, the fear of the Lord. What that really means in practical effects is what we have explained in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, which is a little bit more familiar. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. That is to say, if we fear the Lord, we will not have this feeling of independence. We won't have this feeling of self-sufficiency, but we'll recognize our need of God and His counsel to direct our lives. We'll recognize our need for Him to tell us, in this respect now as we're dressing, His counsel on how to bring up our children. The wise man begins with this fundamental assumption that he needs God to help him in this. It is a fool that despises wisdom and instruction. And very practically what that means is we must be very careful in directing our homes to look to God for His counsel in it. This is the creator of the home showing us how we can have success in our home. And now there's a lot of competing counsel out there. As I mentioned yesterday, our adversary has aimed his guns right at our home, and there are a lot of them aimed. And if you have a young child, you probably remember going to the doctor's office and they hand you a handful of literature, and or you go to the baby store and there's literature jumping off the shelf for you to read. And a lot of it is just, well, a lot of it is fluff and a lot of it is worse than that. And what we have to be careful is to keep our minds in subjection to the Lord, recognizing our dependence and our great need of Him. And the best thing we can do for our children is to take our minds and subject them to the Scriptures and go to the Scriptures with a mind that says, Lord, I want to know how You tell me to direct my home and give me understanding. So we do that with that attitude this morning. We go to Ephesians chapter 6 now. And we do it with the attitude that we need this and we need to understand it very well and we need to flesh out the implications of it, unpack it into our own experience. And we're dealing with this matter of the discipline of children. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. A few comments here before we go on. Make sure we understand precisely what Paul is getting at. First of all, he says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Charles Hodge, in his commentary, I would commend reading all of you to read this passage in Charles Hodge's commentary. He does a good job of explaining the religious nature of obedience on the part of children toward their parents. When Paul says here, children, obey your parents in the Lord, the idea is something like that of children, obey your parents as your religious duty. Obey your parents out of a conviction that this is your obligation under God. Or to put it another way, obey your parents out of a high regard for the Lord Jesus Christ. Obey your parents as your religious duty before God. That is, your out of a high regard for Christ. Now, how this affects us as parents is that we very simply have to teach our children this. It's not enough simply to teach our children to obey. It's not enough simply to teach them to obey or else. And we'll get into that. That's important. But it's very important that we take this and teach them that they should obey us as their parents, because this is what they should do as an expression of their loyalty to Christ. We must teach them that their number one obligation is the same as our number one obligation, and that is to love God with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength. But under that, God's will for them is to obey their parents. And they must understand that the expression of their love for God will be found in obeying dad and mom. In other words, they should understand the Christian nature of obedience. And then Paul goes on to say, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Obey dad and mom. Why? To avoid a spanking. Okay, well, that's a start, I guess. Obey dad and mom because it's right. Because, again, this is your obligation under God. And this is what we should teach our children, that they should obey as an expression of their loyalty to Christ. And then he even gives sort of a motivating clause, honor your father and mother, which is the first command with promise. Now, if you go back to the commandments, you'll find this is the only command with promise. And so it's been taken that what Paul means here is that this is first in importance, in the sense that it is basic, it is foundational, it's fundamental. In other words, you obey your mom and dad out of an expression of your loyalty to Christ. You obey dad and mom because it is right, but you also obey dad and mom because it pays off. This is a command with promise. God has promised to honor this. You do this for God out of your loyalty to Him, and He will in turn honor you for it. In other words, children should be taught that they should obey dad and mom, and they should be taught also that their obedience will result in blessing from God. God honors their faithfulness in obeying their parents. Now, what's interesting here is that Paul has elevated obedience and honor to parents to a much higher level from what we normally hear it. What better lesson is there for children than this one? My children know that if they disobey dad, or if they disobey mom, they're going to get it. It is a very serious offense. But what I hope they know even better than that is that if they obey dad and mom, they are doing what is pleasing to the Lord. That they understand the Christian nature of obedience. So children should be taught that. They should obey out of a high regard for Christ, and we should instill that in their minds. These verses are often preached on, and very often even pastors will address the children during the sermon. You must obey your mother and father. But this notion of the religious nature of it is something I think we often miss. It's easy to overlook. And the obligation that we have as parents is to make sure our children understand that aspect of it. Now then, to the part where the rubber meets the road. There are two words in these verses that I haven't spent any time on yet that are very important. The first one is obey. Children, obey your parents. One thing I want to impress on your minds, and we'll spend a long time on that probably today, is that this word obey is not capable of the broad definitions that it's generally given today. What does it mean to obey? I'm not asking for a response. I wanted you to think through it. What does it mean to obey? Does it mean to you do what you are told when it's convenient? No, it doesn't mean that. Now, it's often taken that way. Does it mean to do what you are told when you feel good? No. Does it mean your child should do what he is told when he's feeling well, when it's convenient, when he understands why? Does it mean that he should do what he is told when he agrees? The answer to all the above, in case you're wondering, is no. To obey simply means to do what you are told, as you're told, when you're told. Now, I may sound like a drill sergeant when I say that, but that really is all that the word means, isn't it? It means to do what we are told. And it's amazing that we have to spend so much time on this, but this is a real area of deficiency even in Christian parents today. They have not taken seriously the meaning of the word obey. But it's basic. And Paul, God is laying it out here as a basic obligation of children to their parents, and we've forgotten the very definition of the word. Children, obey your parents. Now that's an absolute. And I know I sound very dogmatic, and I'll probably sound even worse before the end of the session today. But I don't see any area of gray here. I see only black and white. Either obey or disobey, and we'll unpack this in a few different directions in a minute. But we need to understand that obedience is an absolute. We must tell our children that obedience is doing what they are told, as they are told to do it, when they are told to do it. And they must understand that that's an absolute. Not just when they agree, not just when they understand, not just when it's convenient, not when they just feel good. And it's this that they must do in the Lord. And the next word is honor. Honor your father and mother. Now that's a big word, and it's a broad concept, and it can be fleshed out in a lot of different ways. Paul takes this word in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and even applies it to the area of providing for your parents when they are old. Honor will do that. But that's the concept in this word. Honor is a big word, and it lends itself to a lot of applications. But we have to see that the basic idea is that of your attitude. It's an idea of respect. Now, that works its way out in any number of different directions, but we're talking about an attitude of respect. My favorite illustration of this is the kid that was told in school to sit down. He said, "I don't want to sit down." The teacher came over and said, "Sit down." "I don't want to sit down." "Sit down." "I don't want to sit down." And finally she went over and forced him down into the chair and said, "Sit there or I'm going to paddle you." So he sat there. Finally he says, "I may be sitting down on the outside, but I'm standing up on the inside." And that's the kind of dishonor that we cannot allow. Honor has to do with the respect, a respectful attitude. Now, obviously, what Paul has done here is he has established the authority of parents. And that's another point that we have forgotten in our modern society. I was going to say modern America. I'm not in America. I'm in Canada. The authority of parents is what Paul is establishing here. And that is something that the children must recognize. That the authority figures in their home are mom and dad and not themselves. And again, these two commands, obedience and honor, these are basic. They are absolutes. They are absolute requirements. They are inflexible. And your children should understand that they are inflexible requirements. These are absolute. They must take these commands very seriously if you're going to have success. These are the basic commands that God gives us for our children. They must obey and they must honor. And in your home, this must be an inflexible rule. They must obey. Period. And I mean they must obey from the crib. Not just when they're 18, but from day one, they should be learning to obey mom and dad. And we should not allow one act of disobedience. We should not allow one act of dishonor to go unchecked. This is a basic requirement for children. Now, the rest of our discussion today will really be an outworking of that. And that's why I've spent so much time saying this 10 or 12 different times in 10 or 12 different ways. That this is basic. Obedience is required, and obedience does not have the broad definition that people allow it today. We must not allow one act of disobedience or one act of dishonor to go unchecked. Now, let's go to this matter of some applications to make sure we understand it well. And this will probably be painfully practical, but that is good for us. Let's flesh this out. If our children have to obey, what does that mean? You can really subtitle this applications part, Fred's Gripe List or something. These are things that I see, that I observe, that are very great problems in homes. First of all, is this matter of attitude problems, not curbing attitude problems. Often I see it that parents will allow their, will demand that their children obey, but they will allow a defiant attitude at the same time. We're not doing our job if we do that. We've only gone halfway. And it's not only wrong, it's actually harmful to the child. It has not taught him this important matter of honoring parents. It is not a matter simply of forcing your child to conform. We must teach them to honor, to conform with a good attitude. We cannot allow an attitude of disrespect in the meantime. And you know how this goes. You have a 3-year-old at home. Go to your room.
I don't want to go to my room.
Go to your room.
I don't want to go to my room.
Go to your room.
I don't want to go.
Back and forth. I don't want to go. Go to your room. And finally, Mama goes over and picks the child up, puts him on his bed, closes the door, and she walks out proudly, I won. And you haven't won at all. You haven't dealt with the problem. You have forced conformity to the word, but you have not enforced this matter of honor. You have not curbed the bad attitude. You've not dealt with the situation. You've not really dealt with it until you've corrected the attitude problem involved there. If they argue, if they disobey, if they dishonor, it should be checked. And there should be no defiance allowed whatsoever. I see parents with children sometime and they'll say, okay, let's go now.
I don't want to go.
Let's go now. Man, if I'd have said, I don't want to go. When I was a kid, if I'd have said that, I'd have picked myself up in the middle of next Tuesday. But children get by with that, and in letting them get by with that, we have failed to teach them their basic responsibility to parents. They're not obeying, and they're not honoring. We've got to curb the attitude problems. We have a little phrase in our house. It's called a tune-up. Now, most people use the phrase tune-up in reference to their cars. It needs a tune-up. But I've often noticed that my children needed tune-ups. And there have been several occasions when it's, okay, Jim, get in here. We need a tune-up. And the tools that I have for tune-up are not the same that you have for your car, but it works as effectively. And this really starts very young. You know how it is when you carry that infant and he or she is wanting one thing and you're wanting the other, and they stiffen up and they scream and they do all of this, and that shouldn't go unchecked. You should deal with the attitude problem from early on. And it's not enough for the child to know that mommy's bigger and stronger. They must know that they must obey and honor mommy and daddy. And they must know that very young. It's not enough simply to force them. We must deal with the attitude, and we must check every expression of dishonor to parents. There should be no disrespectful attitude, no sassing, no back talk, no defiant attitudes. At our table, it works its way there too. Gina, eat your peas. Yuck. Oh, okay, you can have some more. Eat your peas and like them. Now, I'm going a little overboard there. But we just don't allow any expression of bad attitude at the table. Now, you will eat those peas and you will do it happily, or you can have more peas and eat them happily too. And if you can't eat them happily, we'll take you out, make you happy, and bring you back and you can eat them then. I'm dead serious about this. We do them no favor by allowing that attitude of disrespect to their parents. We've taught them wrongly. So we deal with the attitude problems, we curb them, and we curb them now. If you put that bad attitude of defiance of that 2-year-old into a 16-year-old, you've got one mess. And you're going to be that grieving, sorrowful parent we saw yesterday in the book of Proverbs. Deal with that attitude now while they are still moldable and young. And do them a favor by it. Number two. I've already alluded to it. This problem of beginning too late, waiting too long to begin discipline. You probably have heard it, maybe you've said it. Oh, he's too young. If he were 14 years old, we wouldn't allow that. But he's only, 18 months. Now, I don't expect an 18-month-old child to act like an 18-year-old. But I do expect the 18-month-old child to be obedient and to show no disrespect to dad and mom. And that works its way out again in so many different areas, but we have to be emphatic on that. It is not too young to begin. As soon as that child can recognize that he can stiffen up and rebel against dad and mom, he can recognize that it's not in his best interest to do it. And we shouldn't think that just because he doesn't understand the words explaining it to him, that he can't understand that he shouldn't do it. He can be brought to understand that. He can be brought to understand that this action produces this very unhappy result. And children can learn that very young, and they should learn it young. Do it while they're young and moldable. My daughter, Gina, has a strong will. And I don't view that as necessarily a detriment. It is a potential danger. There are dangers on all sides of all kinds of personalities. I have a strong will, and I feel like if it is shaped in the right direction, that is an asset. She has a strong will, and of course, she early on began to express the strong will like any child with foolishness bound in his heart is going to express it. And we had to be very diligent in dealing with that with Gina. But I'll tell you, this is not one word of a lie. Gina threw a fit one time. One time only has she ever thrown a fit. She was still in the in the high chair in the kitchen. She was that young. And I've always had the idea, my dad had it too, if you throw a fit, I throw a bigger one. And teach him better that way. She threw a fit. I forget what it was. She didn't want to eat. And she wasn't old enough to understand all the words involved. And so when she threw her fit, I threw mine. She thought I was out of control. I wasn't, but she thought I was. She thought the great day of God's wrath had come. And I tell you, she's not thrown a fit since. And we're back to this point that God's counsel in being firm on these things that God has told us to do, it is not only right, it works. And we must begin immediately. They should not be taught that they can rebel, disobey, show bad attitudes, be defiant until they're 5. And then they have to behave. They should not be taught that at all. As soon as they can recognize that they can be defiant, they can recognize that they shouldn't. There was a time when my daughter was very young, 9 months old. We had just moved into the church where we are now. It was a little over 11 years ago. And we are unpacking in the house. The first day we were there, boxes still all over the floor, and you know how it is, the papers strewn everywhere, and she's having a ball playing with everything. My brother and his wife were there with us, and we're unpacking. And there was one of these shelves built into the wall, and my brother had opened a box, and he found a couple of knickknacks, and so the shelf right there was handy, and he set them there. And Gina came crawling over. She couldn't even walk yet, but she came crawling over to the wall where that shelf was, and she reached up. You know how these little kids at 9 months do, and she pulled herself up, and she's tottering, you know, and she's looking at this knickknack there. And she reached out for it. And this was the first time in her life that we'd had a showdown. This was a defining moment in her life. She reached out, and I was standing across the room, and I said, "No, no." And she looks back. And she looks back at the knickknack. And I could tell this is the moment. This is the first time. Let's do it. Now, before I go with the story, what I did not do, I didn't go and pick her up and move her across the room. I didn't grab the knickknack and put it on the top shelf where she couldn't reach it. I left it there. I wanted her to learn. She looks back. She reaches out again. And I wanted this to be a defining moment, so I let her reach. And I said, "No, no." And she looks back. And I knew she understood. So she does this kind of thing, you know. And she reached out and she grabbed the thing. And she no sooner touched that and I was all over her. And I don't know if it was later that evening or the next day, but she crawls up to the window and she pulls herself up, or that shelf there, and she pulls herself up and she points to the thing and walks away. Round one goes to Dad. And my point in all of that is simply to say, don't begin too late. Begin early. Believe me, it's much easier to deal with a 9-month-old than a 9-year-old or a 16-year-old. Shape their attitudes and shape their behavior while they are young and moldable. You'll do them a favor by it. This third one here, bribery and what is learned by it. This one, it's so hard for me to bite my tongue sometimes when I'm with Christian parents, but I've seen it. Sometimes it's happened at our home. Somebody will be visiting and, "Okay, let's go, honey. We got to go now." "I don't want to go, Dad. I don't plan." "Let's go now." "Oh, I don't know." Yeah, they throw their fit and they start crying. And "Let's go." And no, they're just throwing their fit. And they're, "Okay, now listen, if we go now and if you quit crying, Daddy will buy you an ice cream cone on the way home." Oh, okay. So she sweetens up and Dad feels like he won. And all he did was teach her that she can be rewarded for throwing a fit. "If I throw a fit, I'll get an ice cream cone." And we have taught them the exact opposite thing that they should learn. They should learn that obedience and honor are absolutes and there are no exceptions. Period. I told you I'd sound dogmatic. Number four there. Obedience, sometimes, or allowing exceptions to obedience. I had a friend at our house one time. He was actually a seminary professor. Man should have known better. Had his family over at the house, and they were there, and the kid did something, cut his arm or something. It was a minor injury. They'd been playing all day with our kids, and he's there in the chair, and they're working at it, and I looked over at him, and I said, "Yeah, I had an uncle with a cut like that once. He lost his arm over it." And I thought it was funny. My kids thought it was funny. And the kid looked up at me, you know, and his dad told me, "Oh, you better leave him alone. He's tired. He's been playing all day. He can bite your head off when he gets this tired." And I scratched my head and I thought, what are you teaching that child? That he doesn't have to obey, he doesn't have to honor if he's tired? There are no exceptions to this. And just because he doesn't feel good doesn't mean that he doesn't have to obey. Remember we said yesterday, the essence of discipline is doing what is right even when it is not convenient. He doesn't have to feel like it. He has to do it. Or he's not obeying. Well, I told you I'd be dogmatic. It's a lesson they have to learn. They'll learn it for the rest of their life. It'll be helpful to them. You teach it early. And it's not only right, it's helpful. Next, obedience, sort of. That is, not demanding absolute obedience. You know, when you tell a kid to do something and half hour later it's not done, and you tell, I told you to clean your room. Well, I was gonna. You may be gonna, but you didn't do what you were told, right? Delayed obedience is not obedience. Another problem with this is often parents will allow their children to stand there and say, why? Go clean your room. Why? Now, I may deal with this later. I am one of those that does believe that you should explain to your children the reasons behind commands. They should understand why they do things and all of that. But at the moment of command, they should not be allowed to defy and say, why? They should do it because they are told and because God expects it of them to obey their parents. Obedience is an absolute. This next one here, what I've called noise muscle. Hollering to get obedience. You know how it goes. Go to your room now. Get ready for bed. He plays. Go to your room now. Get ready for bed. He plays. Go to your room now and get ready for bed. He plays. I said go to your room! You know, so he gets up and goes. And you've just taught your kid that he doesn't have to obey until you sound mean. It should be established in your home that your word is the ultimate authority, and it doesn't have to be at a high decibel level. It can be just spoken. I've often tested my kids just to make sure we're on where we should be on this, and I won't say anything. I'll just go like that. Just point. And they ought to be obedient enough to go. If they understand what the command is, they should be expected to do it. I have a friend. He is now in his 60s. He told me that when he was young, his dad was that kind of a dad. He expected absolute obedience. And by the time, this fellow said, by the time I was, I think he said early teens, something like that, something had happened to his dad. I won't forget if it was an illness or an accident, but his dad was bedridden the rest of his life. But he said, from the time all through my teen years, he said, I never rebelled against my dad. He said, when my dad spoke, I jumped. He said, because the authority of his word had been so established, even though I knew he couldn't get up and spank me, the authority of his word was established so much, he said, in my own life, that when he spoke, it was done. We shouldn't expect obedience only when we're able to enforce it physically. We should instill obedience as a principle. So we should demand absolute obedience. We should not have to holler to get it. I've often seen this, and I'm going to spend some more time on it. I've often seen this with parents. I've seen it where parents or a dad, for instance, will want to play a game of volleyball. And here's the two-year-old crawling around, 18 months, something like that, crawling around on the ground. And he sets him over there by the rock and says, stay there. Gives him a rattle or something to play with. And daddy wants to play volleyball. Ooh, daddy, daddy! And he calls him back. No, you stay there. So dad goes over and plays volleyball, and the kid crawls right out on the volleyball court with him. And dad picks him up, puts him back. Now stay there. And dad goes to play volleyball, and the kid comes back. And, you know, this back and forth and ruining our game of volleyball, and I'm getting upset. And finally, the guy says this. He says, well, he says, he's not going to let me play. I'll have to quit. Who's running that home? A little later, he said, can I talk to you sometime? He said, I'd like to talk to you about parenting. Oh, I'd love to, I said. And while we're talking, the kid comes up and picks up his little chair and sticks it right in our face while we're sitting there on the couch. He said, no, put that down. The kid sticks it right in our face. No, put that down. The kid sticks it right in our face. No, put that down. And the kid sticks it right in our face. Finally, the guy picks up the chair and takes it and sticks it in the corner where the kid can't get it. We continue talking a little bit, and pretty soon the kid picks up a candy wrapper, a plastic candy wrapper a cellophane wrapper off the floor, which you don't want a kid eating. He'll stick it down his throat, so the dad takes it away. Kid throws a fit and says, no, you can't have it. And dad pulls it, and the kid comes crawling over the lap, and dad hides it under his leg, and the kid comes crawling over to get it. And I said, do you see what you've taught your child? Your word doesn't mean a thing. Your child has not learned the first step of obedience. I said, now you put that 18-month-old child into an 18-year-old and you've got one bunch of grief. And we've got to see that. We've got to learn this early that they must obey and that that is an absolute. Now this last one I've put here, ignore it, maybe it'll go away. This was actually a problem that started to become a problem with me. I didn't see it until after it happened a few times. Gina, I mentioned, has a strong will. And there were certain circumstances when you'd get her to do something or take her one place or another, certain circumstances that she did not like. And if she didn't like it, you'd know it. And so you know what I found myself doing? I found myself avoiding those circumstances. And so I would just work around it so that I wouldn't encounter the problem. And all of a sudden it hit me one day, what am I teaching that child? I'm not going to avoid this problem, I'm going to push it. And so I would deliberately go to those circumstances so I could deal with the problem while she was young and take care of it. And today we don't have those problems. Don't avoid the problems. If there is a problem area in your child, you must deal with it. Don't ignore it. It won't go away. Deal with it now. All right. Wow, I didn't intend to go that long. Principles of child discipline. First of all, the basics here. As I mentioned yesterday, don't think here only in terms of negative. Discipline is training for all of life. It is shaping their life, shaping their perspective, shaping everything about them. It is teaching them to do what is right even when it is not convenient, even when they're not feeling well and all of that as we've talked. We must teach them the limits, in other words, the boundaries, the guidelines for their living and for their expression. A familiar expression we hear today in popular psychology is we shouldn't hamper their free expression. What I want to tell you is you must hamper their freedom of expression. They must learn that there are expressions they shouldn't have. They must learn that there are certain expressions they can't have in certain contexts. They cannot say certain things in the presence of adults. They can act a different way when they're in certain situations according to the dictates of the circumstances. We should limit their freedom of expression. They should know the boundaries. They should know the guidelines. They should understand what is allowed. And that is what discipline is. It is not simply in terms of spanking, although it's a vital part. We'll see that in a minute. But it is teaching them the limits and the guidelines for life. Teach them what to do, how to think, how to act, what is right, what is wrong. Teaching them to have goals and how to attain them, what not to do in order to attain them, and so on. So that's the broad idea of discipline. The objectives there are giving them direction for living. That's obvious. Protection from the dangers if they don't obey. Moral dangers. And then correction for wrongdoing. Dimension here, again, it's total life. Physical, how they act. Psychologically, how they think. Socially, how they act with others. Moral and spiritual, their obligations to God. All right, I think you see that easily enough. Now the need for discipline. Go to Proverbs chapter 22. Look now at this matter of the need for discipline. Proverbs 22 and verse 15. Very familiar verse. Proverbs 22:15. Foolishness is bound in the heart of the child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. I think that it's a testimony to our naivete that even we Calvinists can forget the doctrine of original sin. And we forget to take seriously enough this statement right here, that foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. Now, if you take that verse seriously, that will direct the way that you discipline for the child. Don't be naive when your child is throwing a fit or rebelling in whatever way. Don't be naive like people do and they say, oh, it's just a stage he's going through. It is not a stage he's going through. It's an expression of a sinful heart. Don't be naive in the approach to discipline. They need it because they have original sin just like you do. And they're affected by it in every aspect of their being, just like we all are. Discipline is necessary for that reason. Time, so I won't develop that. But just let me emphasize it again. You have to recognize that that little angel is a fallen one, okay? I never had to teach my child how to disobey. I had to teach him how to obey. I had to teach him how to do a lot of things. But disobedience, dishonor, it's one of those things I've never had to teach my children how to do it. They somehow understood it naturally. I suspect I'll never have to sit down with my kids and teach them how to lust. I'll never have to teach them how to covet. They know these things naturally. It's because of the natural bent of our beings that we know sin well enough. I have to discipline them because they already are bent towards sinning. And the prospect of the verse is a happy one, and that's our next point, the value of discipline. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now, Baptists don't speak a whole lot, very often, on the matter of the means of grace, but I'd like to introduce another one. The rod of correction is a means of grace. Isn't that the kind of language that's used here? The rod of correction will drive it far from him. In fact, we'll see some other verses maybe later on. The stripes cleanse away evil. Now, I'm not about to introduce this into a formal theology as a means of grace, but you understand what I mean. This is a ministry that we have for our children. And it's a great prospect that somehow God has made it so that although foolishness is bound in our hearts, the rod of correction is an aid in driving it from him. Now that ought to make us all the more diligent in using it. If God offers us this prospect, we should take it very seriously. We should not back off in fear and say, well, our children are born with original sin. Like, well, what are we going to do? This is what you do. You take the rod and you drive the evil from it. I don't understand how all that works psychologically, spiritually. But God tells us that that is the advantage that we have, and we should be diligent in using it. And we should take this, really it's beyond our own a question of our own joy and sorrow. We must see that it's for the child's good. This is a dominant note in so many of the proverbs that are so familiar to us about discipline. Let's run through some of them very quickly. Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 24. These are familiar verses, but I don't think they're familiar enough. So let's take the time to read through them. Proverbs 13, 24. He who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. Why? Because it works. And if you understand that you're doing this for your child's good, Solomon says here, we will use the rod. Chapter 19 and verse 18. Proverbs 19 and verse 18. Chasten your son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. You see the antithesis there? You don't chasten your son and he'll be destroyed. We must understand this is for their good. There is value in it. Chapter 20 and verse 30. Blows that hurt cleanse away evil, as do stripes the inner depths of the heart. It's amazing that a stripe on the backside can cleanse the evilness on the inside. But isn't that what he's holding out? Stripes on the backside, I should say. Proverbs 22. Verse 15, we've already seen, foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of correction will drive it from him. Chapter 23, verses 13 and 14. Do not withhold correction from a child, because if you beat him with a rod, he won't die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell. Chapter 29, verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. The rod and reproof give wisdom. It's amazing that something applied to the backside can help something up on the on the inside. That's the prospect we have to keep in mind. Even verse 17 there, correct your son, and he will give you rest, and he will give delight to your soul. We have this also, you remember, in Hebrews chapter 12, where there's the analogy of God's discipline of His children, and He speaks of our parents who chasten us, and He said, when our fathers chastened us, it was not joyous. He must have had a father like mine. It was anything but joyous, but grievous. Remember the next words? Nevertheless, afterward, it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness. There is a value to the rod. Now you think of this in terms of his own development. An undisciplined child becomes an undisciplined adolescent who becomes an undisciplined adult. And they don't know how to handle difficulty when they're a child. They won't be able to handle difficulty when they are adults. And that is something they need to know when they are adults. It's something they need to know when they are children. I'm convinced that the rising suicide rate has a lot to do with this problem right here. You see children who grow up without any discipline. They don't know how to handle difficulty at all. And when they can't handle difficulty, they grow up a little bit, they still can't handle difficulty, and all of a sudden he commits suicide. And you find, why did he commit suicide? Well, his girlfriend broke up with him. Haven't these things been happening for years? Why are adolescents now committing suicide because their girlfriend broke up with them? And I'm convinced a large part of it traces back to they've not been disciplined to be able to handle unpleasant things. We do this for their own good and for their own development. Think of it in terms of their own happiness, their contentment, even as a child. I always say a disciplined child is a happy child. A disciplined child is a happy child. Always. He understands the bounds. He understands the limits. He understands them well, and he can live very happily inside of those guidelines. And he's a happier child. This was brought home to me very clearly when my son, Jimmy, was 3.5 years old. He had to get his tonsils taken out, which is very young for a tonsillectomy, but there were reasons why it had to be done. He was 3.5 years old. He came out of surgery, and I told the doctors and the nurses I wanted to go into the recovery room to help him. And they said, no, we don't allow it. I said, listen, his biggest problem right now is not pain. His biggest problem is fear. He doesn't know you guys from Adam. And let me in there. It'll help you. I can be pushy and persuasive, and I was, and they let me in. And I walked into the recovery room, and I tell you, it just tore my heart out. Jimmy's lying there in this little crib they had for him, and he's just crying his lungs out. And he was in pain. He was in some fear, not knowing where he was. And I walked up to him, and I started to console him a little. I gave him a minute or two, and finally I said, all right, Jimmy, calm down. Calm down, Jim. And they all looked at me like, yeah, right. And I let him go a little more. He was in a lot of discomfort. I let it go for a minute or two, and finally I said, all right, Jim, now stop it. Stop crying. And I'll tell you, those nurses looked at me like I was the meanest guy in the world. And Jimmy laid there in the crib, and he... you know how they do. And within about 30 seconds, he was dealing with it. And before I'd left that room, every one of those nurses and every one of those assistants that were in there had come up to me and said, we've never seen anything like that. And it just brought home to me this point that a disciplined child is a happy child. He's able to deal with difficulty. He's able to deal with it. It's very important for their own development and their own happiness. You think of this in terms of their own spiritual developments. They must learn how to be submissive. They must learn to be obedient. And the best thing we can do for them is to teach them that obedience is an absolute, and they must know it at home, and then they can learn it very soon, hopefully, we trust, with God as well. So it touches the idea of motives. We do it for their good. We do it because we love them. Now, some attitudes toward discipline. One is the authoritarian attitude, beat them while you can. The other is the permissiveness attitude, allow him to express himself. And we must understand that there are different forms of abuse. And I have a quote here. I love it when people in the world happen to hit it right. And this is interesting here. This man from Harvard says, we do children no favor by letting them intimidate us to the point where we permit or even condone thoughtless or mean activity. At a certain point, excessive leniency and constant permissiveness themselves become, ironically, a version of child abuse. Well, that's just a long explanation of what we knew from the book of Proverbs, isn't it? You let him have his way, and you set your heart on his destruction. If you are overly lenient with the child, you do it to his harm, not for his good. And you see these parents, it drives me nuts. It's usually a mother that'll say, "Oh, I just love him too much. I can't bring myself to spank him." No, you love your emotions. You love yourself, and you can't bring yourself to do something unpleasant. If you loved your child, you'd do what is best for him, even though it is unpleasant. This next thing from the Houston Police Department, you can read that on your own. I thought it was interesting. But again, it's simply an outworking of what we've learned from the Scriptures. So for lack of a better term, I've said the proper attitude there is loving authority. That is firm and loving direction. Authority with responsibility. I've often said to pastors, we cannot expect people in the church to be submissive when we are not responsible in leadership. I've often said to husbands, you cannot expect your wife to be willingly submissive when you're not responsible in your leadership. But if you have responsible leadership, submission comes much more easily. And it's the same in the parent-child relationship. If you have authority that is just naked authority, it's going to be difficult for the child. You may beat him into line, but you're not doing your best for him. But if you have authority with responsibility, showing your affection and your love, showering him with that at the same time, then his submission will come much more easily. He'll learn the limits and the bounds of obedience and good behavior, and it'll come much more easily. By the way, there was that verse we didn't look at, but I mentioned the reference in Titus chapter 2. The older women teach the younger women, and one of the things they're to teach them is to love their children. And that is something we take into consideration here in this matter of discipline. If we love them, we will discipline them. But also, along with the discipline, then we will show our affection and shower them with our love in every way. Well, I'm debating what to do here. Let me jump into this, see if I can do it. The necessary elements of discipline. First of all, instruction. We'll deal with that tomorrow. Secondly, example. We saw that yesterday in Proverbs chapter 4. Example. Now, I'll tell you, we laugh about this at times, and it is amusing in a way. But I'll tell you very seriously, it is one very sobering thought to me to consider that that little boy wants to grow up to be like his daddy. And I'll tell you more, it is almost an overwhelming thought to think that he probably will. And when I think of that, it really puts a check on the way I have to behave. I have to discipline my child not just by telling him and spanking him, I've got to teach him by example. And that is very, very important. This little booklet by Ryle that I recommended, he mentioned in there, someone has said, to give children good instruction and a bad example is but beckoning to them with the head to show them the way to heaven while we take them by the hand and lead them in the way to hell. Our example is just immensely, immensely important. The third necessary element of discipline is, of course, the rod. We have already read these verses in Proverbs that command that. I wanted to spend more time on them, but please take them to heart. Go back, read those verses. The rod that's being spoken of is a stick. What we would call, at least down where we are, it's called a switch. Be careful there, by the way, of what you use for spanking. I've never been one in favor of a hand being used for spanking. It seems to me to be a little potential danger in that. You miss a little and you could harm the child. Spanking, by definition, has to hurt, but we don't want to harm the child. Be careful in what you use. But it should, very obviously, be something that hurts. These little 6-inch rulers that people use, I've always laughed at it. It doesn't do a whole lot. But keep in mind with these scriptural commands that the rod is to be used and that it is valuable. Next, its effectiveness. We've seen that, chapter 20 and verse 30 of Proverbs we saw. Where the stripes cleanse away evil. Blows that hurt cleanse away evil, as do stripes the inner depths of the heart. chapter 29, verse 15, verse 17 as well, speak to the same issue, that the rod is very effective. Now we've got a whole society of psychological teachers, psychotherapists, child specialists, sociologists telling us that we should not spank. And I know it's getting more difficult legally, both in your country and in mine. But we have to remember how valuable it is. They will tell you that it is emotionally harmful. The Scripture tells us it's exactly the opposite. You show me a disciplined child who's properly disciplined, I'll show you an emotionally well-adjusted child. Every time. You show me a child who's not disciplined, I'll show you a child who's maladjusted. They will tell you that spanking your child teaches them violence. I always like to respond by that by saying, yeah, ask a teacher at school. Who are the most violent? Ask the cops on the street. Who are the ones they're putting in jail? It's not the disciplined kids. Who are the ones that are out there being violent, robbing the convenience stores and what? It's not the ones that have been spanked and properly disciplined at home. Don't listen to them when they tell you that. Disciplining, spanking your child does not teach violence. What it does is it curbs violence. That's the whole necessity of it. They'll tell you that it's not necessary. They'll say, well, okay, it's necessary, but only in extreme circumstances, like if they're running out in the street in front of a car, you have to teach them, well, then spank them. And in all of that, all they're doing is admitting that it works, right? The bottom line is that this is a divine directive to use the rod. Don't be wiser than God. God has told us to use the rod. He has told us that it is effective. And the essence of living by faith is taking God at His word and living by it. And that's what we must do with our children. Can I take like 3 more minutes and go a little late, or do they have to run? Okay, let me run very quickly. Practical guidelines on the rod. Number one, I didn't put there, but very obviously what I've said already is use it. Use it. Use the rod. Forcing obedience is not enough. You must use the rod to correct attitudes and to teach them the guidelines. Number two, or first one there on your outline, begin immediately. Begin immediately. Chasten your son while there is hope. Begin immediately. As soon as that child can stiffen up and defy you, he should understand that it's not in his best interest to do it. Begin immediately. Just because he can't understand all the words that you teach him does not mean he can't understand that he should not defy you. He can understand that, and he should be taught immediately. Your child should not get by ever with stiffening up in your arms and defying you when you're taking him somewhere. Teach them immediately that it's not in their best interest. Number two, keep it in perspective. That is, the rod is an essential part of a larger responsibility. It's a means of grace. It's divinely appointed to cleanse away evil. Number three, when it is administered, do it well enough to accomplish the purpose. Now hear this one. When it's administered, do it well enough to accomplish the purpose. Many parents I've seen spank their children only long enough to make them mad. We have always had it as a rule in our house that, well, we didn't teach the kids this, but we had it as an understanding as parents that we will spank them until the cry changes. Now, if you pay attention to your children at all, you know what I'm saying. You start spanking them and all of a sudden they're angry because they're getting spanked. And you keep spanking and keep spanking, and pretty soon they've broken. And they're sorry. Spank them until the cry changes. They've got a diaper on. Don't think that that foot ruler, a 12-inch ruler or whatever, is going to work through a diaper. It's not. All it's going to do is make them mad. Spank them well enough to accomplish the purpose. With that, I have to be careful to say, don't abuse the rod. You would never want to harm the child. But by definition, spanking must hurt if it's going to work. And don't let your soul spare for his crying. And if you lay him with stripes, the proverb says, he'll not die. We need that, don't we?
because we spank him and he cries and it sounds like bloody murder, you know, and we just feel so bad. We need to remember this is for his good. He won't die. He'll be better off for it. Spank him well enough to accomplish the purpose. Don't harm him, but it has to hurt. Now, there are some mistakes that we'll get into next time. We have some questions that deal with this in a little bit. Our time is up, so you may be dismissed.